You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dimitri Martin is known as a cerebral comedian, so it's possible that the significance of the title of his book, This Is a Book, went totally over my head. Mr. Martin is the former senior youth correspondent for The Daily Show. He's written for Conan O'Brien, and for two seasons he had his own show on Comedy Central called Important Things, Dimitri Martin. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed our conversation when it was broadcast earlier this year, and thanks to him, it's become one of my goals to compose the most intelligent sentence ever to start with the word dude. I was happy to welcome him to the show back in April, as he would say, sort of. And our conversation began immediately after I welcomed him to the show.
Thank you. I'm touched. You referenced a lot of things in there. Very economical.
Anybody who knows what you do would have spotted 4 or 5, right?
That's right.
Now, this is a book, and this is a book tour. How do your readings differ from your show?
When I go in front of the people,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah. I mean, is Q&A a little like improv?
Yeah, a lot like it. In fact, it was just last night that I got to do my first official stop, and I got to do Barnes & Noble Union Square, which was fantastic. And right before they brought me out, it dawned on me that I was completely unprepared. I had nothing prepared. I didn't even know, what am I reading? How long am I reading from? How do you do this? I've done stand-up 13 years now, so okay, I have a sense of that. I have some jokes. I improvise a little bit. But I still have the safety net of my material either way.
Well, much of the material in the book, which is very funny, could have been part of your act.
Yeah.
Did you cannibalize your own act?
No. I was
so
very
this
careful.
Is all, it all is new material?
Yes, I was very careful to make sure, just in case there's someone who's seen everything I've done, which I don't think I have even. But if there was such a person, I wouldn't want them to say, wait a minute, I know that from over there or whatever.
But do you just tune into the same part of your brain that you are going to when you're writing your act? Was there a difference when you were writing the book?
There was a difference. In its genesis, there wasn't much of a difference. I'm a daydreamer, and sounds poetic, but I just mean literally walking around daydreaming. So a longtime New Yorker, for me, New York is such a great show. At just anywhere, you know, I can take the train, get out, go for a walk, keep my little notebook with me. I get ideas. They can become one-liners. They can become bits of dialogue, maybe. It could become a movie idea. Maybe it's just a single-panel cartoon. The stuff for the stage is going to be very specific because those are intended to be spoken. But when I got the deal to do the book, I got to go back through those notebooks and say, are there any seeds here for things that just didn't work on stage? Maybe I get a 20-page story out of one of these ideas. And that's what happened.
Well, what about the title of the book? Were you worried about your audience that they may not recognize what it was immediately? Is it fair to say that the digital generation hasn't had much experience with books?
I think that is fair to say. I wish I had the prescience to think that, yes, that's what I'm commenting on. You know, it was more that, like my stand-up CD, which I called These Are Jokes, I realized that what I have to offer is maybe a thread. If there's a consistency in the work, there'd just be a thread, and that might be a perspective, whereas the pieces themselves don't relate directly to one another.
Well, you begin the book with an arrow directing the reader towards the text in a chapter called How to Read This Book.
Yeah.
Clearly, whatever they think of you, would you describe your public as particularly cerebral, sort of?
The more I get out there and the better the lighting in the room that I'm in, the better sense I get of my public. So, for example, just doing that Barnes & Noble event, that was really helpful for me. Usually I'm in a theater, lights are down depending on the particular setting that night. I can't quite see everybody. I know there are college kids out there, maybe some older couples and some high school kids. But I don't really get a sense of the composition. It's usually 50-50 gender-wise, which is nice. So now I'm getting a better sense of how cerebral they might be.
Is the title a reflection of your legal training?
No. Like, if it is, it's not conscious.
Some stuff in here. For example, you have I've always been amused by legal documents where each empty page is printed with the sentence, this page intentionally left blank, and you have a joke about that in your book, although I'm not sure it's as funny as the real thing, which is kind of weird, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, for me, I like thinking of the book as this little, maybe its own little show, in as much as you can move through it. Now, the sequence with which you move through it is dictated by, you know, you can start anywhere in the book and go back and forth. But I did spend a lot of time as a proofreader after going to law school. So in a way, maybe unconsciously, that's a reference even to that time when I was reading a lot of documents.
Did you intend to be a lawyer when you went to law school, or was it just what a liberal arts major who is a good test taker does after college to please his parents?
I liked that. It was like my subconscious asking me a question. It's perfect. I did. I intended to be what I thought was a lawyer. And by that, I mean, I think from seventh grade, my goal was, I'm going to be a lawyer. And I remember even saying corporate lawyer, having no idea what that meant. It just sounded a little more impressive if I put corporate in front of lawyer.
You make more money that way.
Make more money. And L.A. Law was the show when I was a kid that my parents watched. They said, yeah, me, I'm going to be a corporate lawyer. These guys seem very cool. Then I got to law school and I realized that thoroughness was a very important aspect of this job. And that's where I got into trouble. I was like, I'm not a thorough person.
Were you already doing stand-up when you were in college and law school?
No. In fact, I dropped out in, I guess, the end of second year of law school, so May must have been. And the first time I got on stage was July, so there was a lag there.
But you had already done stuff. Didn't I read that you went to some classes in law school in a gorilla suit?
Yeah, I think that's generous. If you call that me doing stuff, sure, we'll call that a
well,
bit.
Well,
yeah.
You were obviously saying, look at me at that point, and I want to be funny.
For sure. And you know what? I was more and more doing that, and it was kind of polluting my regular life in a way that I was becoming the quote-unquote funny guy, read annoying guy. You know, I think I was trying to break out, and I didn't realize I should just get up on stage. Like, that's where it belongs.
Did you rent that gorilla suit?
No, sadly, I own that gorilla suit.
You still have it.
Somewhere. That was a Christmas present. It was a ski suit. I got it so that I could snow ski in it, which, talk about needing attention. It's like, oh, hey, there's a gorilla again. Look, he just fell.
How did your family feel about your walking away from law school and a full scholarship?
Everyone was very disappointed, and it was very clear that everybody was disappointed. I can't remember one person saying, go for it. You should do it. Everyone said, what are you doing? 1 year left. Just do it.
But you say you're obsessed with summations and increments, and I imagine they come out of that legal training.
Yeah, I think to some degree, and it might be even a case where maybe what attracted me to legal training or the idea of it was that interest in kind of summation and increments and breaking things down and putting little pieces together, logic.
So how do you summarize?
How do I summarize? You mean just in
what life? What do you summarize?
What I summarized years ago, and it'll be a long story, so I'll truncate it. I did a one-man show in which I discussed a point system that I made out of my life. And the intention behind the point system was that I would find a way to balance the things that I was trying to do, whether I was trying to pay my bills, write new jokes, make money, do temp jobs, hang out with friends. What I found was that if I got really excited about something, I would go into that and spend so much time doing it. Like when I started trying to paint, I got a little paint set and I was like, I want to try to paint. Well, there I go. I get into painting. Now that week, everything else has gone into the garbage. I've just neglected everything else and I've become obsessed with painting. Well, I learned, you know, you leave school. I have responsibilities. I have to be a grown-up. So I tried to, I guess you'd call it a summation, tally just by the amount of time and the number of tasks that I was doing each week. At the end of each week, say, have I achieved some sort of a balance here? And what I found was I absolutely didn't. I failed miserably at it.
My guess is Dimitri Martin, his book is called This Is a Book. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. Well, I assume that a lot of it, of what you do comes out of the sorts of stray thoughts that certain kinds of people have.
Yeah.
Like plays on words, for example, quirky arrangements of words and sentences. I'm assuming that as a kid you loved puzzles and games.
Absolutely.
And puns.
Yeah.
But you also say that people who like brain teasers never have teased their hair. What do you think that is?
I don't know, but I have a plethora of data on that. Just coming from the Jersey Shore, I grew up in New Jersey. I think there's there are certainly people who must like clubbing and doing all that stuff and then also like to sit down with the puzzle book. What I found was there were two very different camps where I grew up. And I was on the quieter side, and I liked my little puzzle books and drawing. You know, it's just who I was.
Wasn't your father a priest in the Greek Orthodox Church?
Yeah, he was a great priest.
Did he give sermons?
He did.
So was he in an odd way a role model when you decided to get up there and perform?
Absolutely, and it was something I discovered later. Thinking back, I was an altar boy until I went to college. And I was head altar boy, I think, the last year or two. I had an inn. My dad was a priest. But still, I was a ranking altar boy, and I was therefore behind the pulpit. You know, I mean, we were off to the side. So by the time the sermon came at the end of the service, I could see my father from behind giving this speech. And I remember now, I recently remember this, he never had a typed out sermon. What he had was a few words jotted on the back of an envelope or something just lying there on the pulpit. And then he would do like 20 minutes or 25 minutes, very anecdotal, personal stuff, really funny. He had a very natural, great sense of timing. He was a big comedy fan too.
But I suspect he didn't create palindromes and rearrange the words on the bottle of a Rolling Rock beer, make it into a poem.
That was more my area, which I didn't know at the time. That's something that came later for me.
Was it a poem about beer?
Yeah.
Is that an illustration of how you make comedy? Start with something and then make it into something else?
I think that's one way to do it. Recently, somebody was asking me about, you know, what's funny, what is comedy about? And of course, it's very subjective and it's going to be person to person. But for me, what I can say is usually if I'm laughing right before that, I'm surprised. Pretty close to the laugh. I've been surprised by something.
Of course, you can't laugh at your own jokes. That is not acceptable in a comic.
That's right. If I've laughed on stage, of course, I guess it depends on the comic. But for me, I think I agree with you. If I end up laughing on stage, I'm usually laughing at futility. Because when you're a one-liner comic, you have very clear destinations. And the failure is unmistakable when you get to a punchline and there's silence. Unless the audience is playing a trick on you, that means we've got a problem.
Well, how have you dealt with that? And how did you deal with hecklers when you first started?
When I first started, it took a little while until I really got heckled.
You mean you had to be better to get heckled?
No, you know, I think maybe people just were like, oh, this kid, look at this nice young man trying whatever. I don't know, whatever they thought. Or, you know, I was getting 5 minutes here and there. When I got a little more stage time, then there were bigger windows to get heckled. At first, I never thought I wanted to improvise or go off my material. I just wanted people to sit there, listen. Here are my jokes. Here are my ideas. Let me get through them. Over the years, I don't enjoy heckling. I think it's really so rude. It's just crazy to me that somebody would do that to someone who's putting himself out there up there. But now what it does is it gives you as a comic a chance to take the room to a different level, to shortcut. They're raising the emotional stakes in that room. They're challenging you. If you win this, the audience is with you. If you lose all their confidence. So it's kind of a great opportunity.
And I'm sure you have prepared responses to hecklers.
Yeah, and you know, more than that even, is you develop muscles where you just trust yourself. And you go up there and you're just like, I've done this 5,000 times, 10,000 times. I'll handle it, whatever they say.
You mentioned you're interested in art. You also tweet drawings, don't you?
Yeah.
Is one tweeted picture worth 140 words?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty low bar. I'd say it's worth about 140 words, maybe even more.
I love your chapter about the cat calendar. What was the inspiration for that?
Yeah, the cat calendar, I'm allergic to cats. That doesn't mean I dislike cats. What it means is I'm not a cat person. Biologically, I can't be a cat person unless I have some sort of a sadomasochistic bent to myself and I like cats. So I never grew up with a cat. I didn't have a cat who was a friend. If I saw a cat, I usually didn't know their name. It was just some cat over there. What I noticed is people who do like cats often are very passionate about cats. And so there we have a whole body of cat literature, cat calendars, cat word a day things. I don't know, whatever. So I just thought it might be funny to have one of the pieces be from a publishing company that published a calendar that is against cats.
Gilbert Gottfried, who was on before you, has gotten a lot of trouble for some of his jokes. Are you concerned about the reaction of PETA or the vegans to your calendar proposal?
Not really. What I found over the years is that my edges are very dull when it comes to inspiring controversy, but maybe this book will be a first for me. But I don't usually end up in edgy territory with people, but we'll see, maybe.
You also juggle, ride a unicycle.
Exactly.
Do you have any other hobbies that'll turn off girls?
Well, palindromes is a pretty good one. I don't know if that's a hobby, but certainly, you know, and that's not to say, oh, there are no women who like palindromes. I'm not excluding women from the world of palindromes.
Do you have a favorite palindrome that you've come up with?
Yeah, there's one I put in the book that was my favorite for a while, and it was snub no man. Nice cinnamon buns. I just like it. I like the absurdity of it and that it works.
One of my producer's husbands wore sweater vests until her children heard your routine about vests. And after that, he couldn't stand up to all the torments.
It's a terrible thing to hear and an honor at the same time.
You won the Perrier Award. What is that for?
The Perrier Award now has a different name, but for a long time it was called the Perrier Award. And that is the prize they give for what is deemed the best show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, a month-long comedy festival and arts and theater festival.
And who chooses the winner?
There's a panel of five, no, maybe it's more, it might be 10, 7, some sort of number like that of judges who go and see just about every show they can at the festival.
So it's kind of like the Booker, because every time you go to England or Scotland, they always seem to mention that you are the winner of the prestigious Perrier Award.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how regional things are. It is prestigious over there. Over here, it's more of a curiosity.
So now you've written a book on top of writing comedy for yourself and for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Does this just broaden all of the possibilities for the future, or do you have any sense of where you want to go?
The next thing I want to do is I want to write a movie that I can direct, something that I'd probably shoot in Toronto or Detroit or someplace where it is affordable.
Yeah. Toronto, but make it about New York, of course.
Maybe, yeah, something like that. I've been trying to brainstorm ideas with that in mind, whereas with the book, I didn't have to worry about budget so much. I don't have to worry about producing short stories. I used to write them, you know.
The book that we've been talking about is called This Is a Book. It is published by Grand Central Publishing. My great thanks to Dimitri Martin for being on our show today.
Leonard, thank you so much for having me.